Djibouti, thankfully, is today at the forefront of our global efforts against terrorism. And because of it...
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Kerry to discuss humanitarian pause in Yemen. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says he will discuss a proposed humanitarian pause for war-ravaged Yemen when he travels to Saudi Arabia. VOA's Pam Dawkins, who is traveling with Kerry, says the Secretary of State also announced $68 million in new U.S. aid to Yemen during a stop in the East African nation of Djibouti on Wednesday. The State Department says the funds will support agencies providing food, water, shelter, and other assistance to 16 million Yemenis in need. In Djibouti, Kerry met with President Ismail Omar Gela and Foreign Minister Mahmoud Ali Yusuf, who and thanked them for their assistance to hundreds of Americans who sought refuge from the violence in Yemen. A day after becoming the first Secretary of State to visit Somalia, Kerry is also the first to go to Djibouti. Court in Afghanistan sentenced four men to death Wednesday for the deadly mob beating of a 27-year-old woman in March. The men are part of a group of 49 people put on trial in connection with the assault, including 19 police officers accused of either failing to stop the attack or taking part themselves. The Kabul court also sentenced eight of the defendants Wednesday to 16 years in prison. False accusations that the victim, a woman named Farhunda, desecrated the Muslim holy book, the Quran, sparked the brutal attack in the central part of Afghanistan's capital on March 19th. Her killing sparked protests in Afghanistan and widespread outrage elsewhere, with Afghan President Ashraf Ghani and the United Nations condemning the attack. This is VOA News. More people than ever have been forced to flee their homes because of violence and conflict. A new report by the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center finds a record-breaking 38 million people worldwide were internally displaced in 2014, including 11 million who were newly displaced. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the launch of the report in Geneva.
Authors of the report note that the figure of 38 million internally displaced people is equivalent to the populations of London, New York, and Beijing combined. The report finds the majority of last year's 11 million newly displaced were in five countries alone: Iraq, South Sudan, Syria, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Nigeria. The worst displacement, it says, occurred in Iraq, where 2.2 million people were forced to flee from attacks by the Islamic State militant group. But Syria has the highest number of internally displaced people in the world, with at least 40% of its population, or 7.6 million people, uprooted within their country. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
British Prime Minister David Cameron and opposition leader Ed Miliband are making final appeals to voters ahead of the parliamentary election Thursday that surveys show is too close to predict. Results of a national survey Wednesday showed Mr. Cameron's Conservative Party with a support from 33% of British voters, with Miliband's Labour Party a point behind. Mr. Cameron has promised, if re-elected, to hold a referendum on whether Britain should stay in the 28-nation European Union. The question of Scottish independence from the United Kingdom remains as a key issue. Both men have cast the election as a referendum on the country's economy, the world's fifth largest. Miliband has attempted to characterize Mr. Cameron's Tories as the party of the wealthy.
This is the clearest choice that has been put before the British people for a generation, between a Tory government that works only for the privileged few.
More than 45 million people are eligible to vote at 50,000 polling stations set up throughout Britain. French investigators say the co-pilot who deliberately brought down a German Wings airliner in the French Alps in March, killing 150 people, apparently practiced such a controlled descent during an earlier flight the same day. Settings for selected altitude on the autopilot were adjusted several times and set as low as 30 meters as the plane descended on the first leg into Barcelona. This from a report issued Wednesday by the French authority BEA. In a 30-page report, the investigators say co-pilot Andreas Lubitz was alone in the cockpit during the initial descent, as he was when the German's flight made its fatal descent hours later during a return to Dusseldorf, Germany. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiswu Heben coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Djibouti, thankfully, is today at the forefront of our global efforts against terrorism. And because of its strategic location and its proximity to areas of concern, Djibouti is a frontline state in the efforts to stand up against terrorism.
That's Secretary of State John Kerry on a tour of East Africa. Details coming up.
Also, Nigeria says troops have rescued another 25 women and children as they continue to penetrate the Siambisa forest and clash with Boko Haram insurgents.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry held meetings in the Horn of Africa nation of Djibouti today, the latest stop on his foreign tour that included a stop in Somalia yesterday. Kerry met with President Ismail Omar Geleh and former Minister Mahmoud Ali Yusuf. He also met later with U.S. officials at the U.S. military base camp Lemene. He thanked the African leaders for their assistance to hundreds of Americans who sought refuge from the recent violence in Yemen. Secretary of State Kerry says he will discuss a proposed humanitarian pause for Yemen when he travels to Saudi Arabia.
VOA's Pam Dawkins is traveling with Kerry and says the secretary also announced $68 million in new U.S. aid to Yemen. The State Department says the funds will support agencies providing food, water, shelter, and other assistance to 16 million Yemenis in need. Saudi Arabia, meanwhile, has conducted airstrikes against Houthi rebels trying to overthrow the Yemeni government. Kerry also praised Djibouti for its support in the fight against terrorism.
Extremism and violence and terrorism is not new to this generation. Most recently, with the rise of Daesh and al-Shabaab, al-Nusra, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and various other entities, people have regrettably found a way to exploit a great religion and to present it in a completely false manner. They take advantage of young people particularly, and particularly those who don't have jobs, don't have opportunities, people who are poor, and twist their minds, indoctrinate them, and send them on missions of death and terror to literally destroy, not to build, not to provide a future. Djibouti and its leadership understand this. And they are pushing back against this kind of extremist effort, as are every country in the region. Djibouti, thankfully, is today at the forefront of our global efforts against terrorism. And because of its strategic location and its proximity to areas of concern, the threat that it faces from al-Shabaab extremists on its own border or people attacking its border, Djibouti is a frontline state in the efforts to stand up against terrorism. We will continue to work very closely with the Djiboutian government on counterterrorism strategies for all of East Africa, for the Arabian Peninsula, as part of our effort to try to offer the kinds of young people I met today at the Salam Mosque the future that they want so much.
Yesterday, Secretary of State John Kerry made a historic visit to Somalia, becoming the first top-ranking U.S. diplomat to visit the war-torn country. Somali Foreign Minister Abdisalam Hadley Omar told VOA Somali Service that the visit shows Somalia has turned around and is open for business. He said talks with Kerry focused on giving Somalia a stronger government and prospects for reopening a U.S. embassy in the capital. On Monday, in Kenya's capital, Nairobi, Kerry announced millions of dollars in new aid for hundreds of thousands of refugees in Kenya, most of whom are from Somalia.
Nigeria says troops have rescued another 25 women and children as they continue to penetrate the Sambisa forest and clash with Boko Haram insurgents. Army spokesman Colonel Sani Usman says many militants were killed in a recent firefight and only one Nigerian soldier died. Five soldiers were wounded. Amnesty International says over 2,000 women and children abducted by Boko Haram in the last year have been recovered. Among those rescued, the government has not reported identifying any of the more than 200 Chibok schoolgirls kidnapped a year ago. Amnesty says the rescues are encouraging, but only a small step in securing the safety of the thousands that have been kidnapped. In a recent report, Amnesty interviews many of the girls. Their accounts reveal how they were executed, tortured, raped, and forced into marriage in camps and towns controlled by the terrorist. Daniel Iyer is a Nigeria researcher for Amnesty International. He said Amnesty is calling for the Nigerian government to provide those rescued with the care and privacy they now need.
We think it's essential that the women and girls that have been recovered from Boko Haram receive medical support, psychological care, and are also given the privacy that they need to overcome the trauma of their experiences. We've spoken to a number of women and girls that have been released from Boko Haram control, and they've told us about the awful experiences and things that they've either suffered themselves or have witnessed in towns or camps controlled by Boko Haram. We've had accounts of Boko Haram torturing people, those people that don't follow their rules, also using rape and forcing women and girls into marriage with their members. So the experiences that these people have been through clearly quite traumatic, and they need that medical and psychosocial support urgently.
What is involved in helping someone who has been through such a horrible experience to really get back in touch with their community?
First of all, most urgently, you know, medical support is needed. We've had some reports that some of the women and girls who were raped by Boko Haram have actually fallen pregnant, and so it's essential that they receive the full range of sexual and reproductive health services that should be available to them. But secondly, overcoming trauma is something that requires ongoing support, and that's both formal support from the health system, psychological support, but also special measures are often required to reintegrate people into normal family and community life again. And there's clearly a risk in this case of stigmatization. A lot of people are frustrated, obviously, by what Boko Haram has been doing in northeast Nigeria, and some people are concerned that those people that were abducted by Boko Haram, who stayed there for a long time, are somehow associated with Boko Haram, and so reintegrating them into the community does require additional effort.
What about the families? What type of support do they need, the families of the women and girls?
Well, I think obviously it will be of an immense relief to them to have their family members back with them. But in the past, you know, we have spoken to people, family members found it very difficult being separated from their relatives for such a long time and themselves required psychological assistance. And I think that that's putting more pressure on the system in northeast Nigeria.
Also, you all have called for the Nigerian government not to exacerbate lengthy security screening and in detention. So what exactly does that mean?
When these girls and women have been recovered by Nigerian security forces, they initially were kept for several days in the custody of the Nigerian military and were screened, presumably to check that they were not themselves Boko Haram members. You might be aware there's been a rise in suicide bomb attacks in northeast Nigeria where women or girls were used as the carriers of bombs. So there is some genuine security concerns behind this. But what we have seen in other cases is that Nigerian security forces have detained people for sometimes more than 2 weeks to conduct these screenings. And what's essential is that those screening processes are as short as possible and that people are able to receive medical and psychological support while ever they're in detention.
Have you received any response from the government that they will shorten this period or not have them go through it?
We haven't received direct response from the government. I believe it was in the news today that the military had handed over some people from some of these rescued women and girls from their custody to that of the National Emergency Management Agency. So it does appear that the process has been quicker this time around, although we haven't yet been able to verify that story, those media reports.
Also, your organization, Amnesty International, is saying that survivors of this form of violence and gender-based violence and rape, they have a right to receive full reparations. So what is involved in getting that?
Well, that can be a number of different things. So first of all, it's about repairing the harm suffered. That's why we've called first and foremost for medical care, psychological support, and privacy to overcome the trauma of the experiences. But it also includes public recognition of what has happened to the people, the right as victims to public acknowledgement of the truth. It also includes compensation to victims of human rights abuses and violations. And in other cases, you know, there have been legal proceedings where victims have been awarded financial compensation, although it doesn't necessarily need to be that. It's just important in this case that the Nigerian government puts thought into and consults those affected by violence in northeast Nigeria about what reparations and what form of compensation would be most appropriate to them.
Daniel Ayer is a Nigeria researcher for Amnesty International. He spoke with me from London. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Swuhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry held meetings in Djibouti today, the latest stop on this on his foreign tour that included a stop in Somalia yesterday. And Nigeria says troops have rescued another 25 women and children as they continue to penetrate the Sambesi forest and clash with Boko Haram insurgents. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
UN Special Envoy for Ebola, David Nabarro, says combined new Ebola infections in Sierra Leone and Guinea are below 20 for the first time since the West African health crisis began more than a year ago. Nabarro calls the lower numbers of infections extraordinary progress. He says another hopeful sign is that health officials identified known sources of infections for more than half of the new cases. Liberia is the first of the three West African nations to weather the health emergency and has had no new cases for almost 40 days. The World Health Organization says if Liberia finds no new cases by Friday, the country will be declared free of the virus that has killed almost 11,000 people in West Africa.
The UN Refugee Agency says more than 40,000 Burundians have fled the violence in Bujumbura in the last 2 months, and the numbers are increasing. Most have sought shelter in Rwanda. Smaller numbers have crossed borders into Tanzania and the Democratic Republic of Congo. In a statement today by Tanzanian President Jakaya Kikwete said the foreign ministers of Tanzania, Kenya, Rwanda, and Uganda are going to Burundi to assess conditions. Mr. Kikwete urged Burundians to resolve the political crisis peacefully. Protesters oppose efforts by Burundi's ruling party to nominate President Pierre Nkurunziza for a third term of office. A constitutional court ruled the nomination does not violate the constitution. Today, pro- and anti-government demonstrators clashed in the capital. Some protesters have accused the youth wing of the ruling party of attacking them. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Bujumbura.
The sun is setting in Musaga, a neighborhood about a 10-minute drive from central Bujumbura. This is one of the poor suburbs hit by violent protests. Here, youths armed with stones and sticks have lit bonfires on the road. Some of them surge when they see us and demand that we reveal our identities. A minute later, we are taken to the leader of the protesters and introduced to him. At first, the man is suspicious. He trusts nobody on a night when tension is high. We cannot talk to someone we don't know, he says. All your colleagues are gone. Let's talk tomorrow. For now, we cannot talk about anything. After a while, however, he opens up. He says the protesters are blocking the road, so police and the ruling party's youth wing, the Imbonerakure, cannot access their neighborhood. Imbonerakure, we have all chased them away from here. They are not here, he says. These youths work with the government and their militias. When we return to Masaga on Wednesday morning, the situation is the same. One of the protesters' youths tells us they inspect vehicles and check visitors for their own safety.
Raia wanapita, lakini kama gari zao, tunaanza kuanza kuchakaza. Tusione kama
ndani. Civilians are allowed to pass, but we check their cars if they are carrying criminals. We are doing so because they can bring in criminals, police and weapons. That is why we are checking all these vehicles. In the neighborhood of Kanyosha on Wednesday, protesters and some youths supporting the president attacked each other. Nkurunziza's supporters say the protesters attacked their party office and broke windows. When VOA visited the scene, there was a heavy presence of both police and the army in the streets. Nikiziza David is a member of the ruling party's youth wing, whose name Imbonerakure means those that see far. The president's opponent have accused the youth of attacking protesters and working with the police to suppress the demonstrations against President Nkurunziza. David says the Imbonerakure, like the protesters, have a stake in the country.
We don't accept this. This is we make me troubles. We are Burundian. We like our country. We love our country. Why they use many efforts in order to disturb our permanence? This is our office of permanence.
In an interview, Imbonerakure leader Dennis Carrera denied the allegations against the group, but admit some members were involved in criminal activities. They can be wrong and they can also be violent, but they are doing so as an individual, not as Imbonerakure, he says. You are supposed to differentiate between these two. We have to punish him according to the law. Back in the neighborhoods like Musaga, demonstrations continue and main roads are still closed in Bujumbura. So far, police have succeeded in blocking protesters from reaching the city center. But in some neighborhoods, it is the police who are prevented from going forward. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Bujumbura.
Zimbabwean officials made a plea to Western governments and international organizations today to resume direct aid to the country. But as Sebastian Mhofu reports from Harare, the UN and the United States seem to be happy with the current arrangements.
At a meeting, Zimbabwean Finance Minister Patrick Chinamasa said that aid to Zimbabwe is currently caught fragmented, as not all of it is being channeled to prop up the country's ailing economy.
When development assistance is received by us, we have an obligation to say thank you because it is filling a financing gap. I can't say thank you if I don't know where the assistance has gone and whether we need it and whether it is playing a transformative impact in our economy.
Western countries stopped direct funding to Zimbabwe's government in 2002 when they slapped its leadership with targeted sanctions for alleged election rigging and human rights abuses. Since then, foreign aid to Zimbabwe has gone through United Nations agencies and other aid organizations. At the meeting Wednesday, UN Resident Coordinator in Zimbabwe, Bishop Parajuli, said a lot has been achieved using this system, including a 33% drop in maternal mortality, an increase in the immunization rate, and reducing mother-to-child transmission of HIV by more than half.
Within this continuous effort, we are aiming to support and address some major and persistent challenges remained, with the stubbornly high level of poverty at 63% nationally and 76% in rural area, and help build resilience to more firmly address root causes of poverty and inequalities and other continued challenges.
The U.S. government and other Western countries have cited several factors for their refusal to give aid through the government. These include controversial economic policies, fears of corruption, and widely documented human rights violations by President Robert Mugabe's government. U.S. Ambassador to Zimbabwe Bruce Wharton was among many Western dignitaries that attended the meeting with Chinamasa. Afterward, he explained what the U.S. would like to see before resuming direct aid.
We think that the foundation for everything is respect for the rule of law. Secondly, I think implementation of the new constitution. Third, we think that clear protection, respect for private property, is absolutely essential to get the economy going again. And then fourth and finally, I think a very clear and predictable, transparent investment framework, so that someone who's thinking about investing in Zimbabwe knows what the rules are with great clarity and can count on those rules being the same next week or next year.
The U.S. is the leading provider of humanitarian assistance to Zimbabwe. Through the U.S. Agents for International Development, USAID, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, PEPFAR, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. In Zimbabwe, the U.S. funds food aid, HIV/AIDS prevention programs, and programs to promote democracy, good governance, and economic growth. Last year alone, USAID provided nearly $25 million in emergency food aid. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News in Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali, coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehiz Huhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Kelvin Fowler, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, the African Union declared 2015 the year of women's empowerment in acknowledgement of the increasing role women are playing in Africa's development. We'll introduce you to women from the African diaspora who will share their personal stories on empowering themselves and their sisters on the continent for Africa's future. That's Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one I get, this one I get.
Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best. Right here on VOA Africa.